Do you have any time for rebuttal?
I'd ask to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
May it please the court, I'm Caitlin Reynolds, and I'm here today to represent Kenesha Hannon on this appeal. The facts in this case were not in dispute, and in fact were stipulated to. The issue here is whether Ms. Hannon's actions in leaving her 5-year-old son and her 4-month-old daughter alone in a car for less than 15 minutes while she was in a store nearby rose to the level of showing that her actions were gross, wanton, and culpable enough to show a reckless disregard for human life. The facts were that it was in the evening, but the weather was mild. It wasn't extremely cold. It wasn't extremely hot. Ms. Hannon was absent from the car and in the store for less than 15 minutes. I think the actual count was 14 minutes and about 34 seconds. There's no evidence that she was intoxicated. When the officer was at her car, Ms. Hannon was able to come out of the store and speak with the officer and ask him why he was there speaking with her children.
The statute seems to speak in terms of enhanced negligence, for lack of a better way of putting it. So gross, wanton, culpable, short, reckless disregard. Typically, when we're dealing with a negligence standard, and I always struggle when we're dealing with a negligence standard in a criminal case because it seems to be incongruent, but typically when we're dealing with those sort of determinations, aren't we more or less looking at a factual circumstance? And if there is any evidence in the record whatsoever to support a factual determination consistent with the statute, that from a standard of review circumstance, we have to affirm the decision.
I think that is a correct statement of the standard of review and the state of the law. I would ask the court to consider Comer versus Commonwealth, which is a recent case involving.
Given that we sent you all an email, that was my next question. So
the court did ask us to review that case, and actually, the public defender in my office had sent me that case as well, thinking that it was on point, and I think that it was. So in that case, the court was presented with the same issue. The only evidence in that case, as far as what actions to consider that rose to this level of gross, wanton, and culpable conduct were the fact that the mother in that case was intoxicated. And the court in that instance said that they had to look at the intoxication and they had to determine whether those actions created a substantial risk or a probability or the potential of a serious injury or death to the child, considering the totality of the circumstances. And the court in that instance said that there was not enough evidence to show that her actions were so gross, wanton, and culpable that they did show a reckless disregard for human life. And I would argue that this case is similar. It's procedurally similar. The facts are different, but I think that case should be persuasive. Given the totality of the circumstances, what we have is the mild weather. Ms. Hannon did leave her children in the car, but apparently she was able to observe what was going on. She came out to the car when the officer approached her car, and she spoke with the officer and said, why are you talking to my children? So she had seen what was going on and was able to respond to it. Some of the other case law that address similar situations talk a lot about whether the parent or guardian, in many instances it does tend to be the mother, is inaccessible to the children. So, for example, a mother could be inaccessible due to a very high level of intoxication. There was a case where one of the factors that the court looked at was the high levels of intoxication, especially with intoxication coupled with taking Ambien or other substances. There's a case, I believe, cited by the Commonwealth, Barnes versus Commonwealth. It was a mother who had left her children in the apartment while she had left to buy groceries. She returned to the home, I believe, while the officers were there, had 10 bags of groceries. So she had left. She was in a completely separate physical location from her home, had no ability to observe what was going on or to respond to any issues that might arise. In contrast, in our case, we have Ms. Hannon, who is within eyesight enough to come out and respond to the officer when he is there at the car.
Does the record reveal that she came out because she saw the officer, or was she done with her 15 minutes of shopping?
I don't know if the record says one way or the other. The record certainly does not say that she has any purchased items with her.
Would that make a difference if one was because she could see and the other was she was just done with running the errand?
I think it possibly could, but I think that the record does contain the fact that she came out and said, why are you speaking to my children? And there is no evidence in the record that she had completed any purchases. And I think she came out and engaged with the officer. I know in the Commonwealth's brief they said that Ms. Hanna was lucky that the stranger who approached the car was friendly, but I think from the record, the only evidence of anyone who approached the car was the officer. There was another gentleman in the parking lot, Mr. Custer, who had actually called the police, but he was sitting in his car. And I think the record makes clear that the officer went and spoke with Mr. Custer, and there's no evidence that Mr. Custer approached the car or spoke with the children in any way. I don't believe anyone from the record. It's demonstrated that anyone other than the officer came and spoke with the children, and Ms. Hanna did respond to the officer.
Am I correct that there was no evidence presented to describe the surrounding environment of this general dollar store, whether there were highways on either side or the amount of traffic that might be going past or anything that would demonstrate an enhanced danger to the children should they get out of the car?
I don't think there was any specific evidence on that point. I think the officer may have, in his notes, sort of generally said that there was steady traffic, but I don't think there was any particular discussion of the surrounding roads or what steady meant or how many cars were coming in and out of the parking lot or the parameters of the parking lot or anything of that nature. I think the record is silent as to those particular issues. I think there's also case law that says that the finder of fact can infer inherent dangers, but I think given the Comer case, I think that there has to be a showing that whatever these inherent dangers are, that they create a substantial risk or probability of a potential of serious injury or death. And I think in this case what we don't have are any facts or evidence that show that there is such a substantial risk or probability that these potential dangers would come to fruition. I think what we have at best is speculative harms. There is no evidence that either child had any injury or was distraught or was upset in any way. They were able to respond to the officer.
Well, under B, they don't have to actually prove the injury. They just have to prove a substantial risk or probability of the injury, correct?
I agree. I agree that that is a correct statement of the law, but I think that it has to be a substantial risk and a substantial probability of it. And I think what we have here are merely speculative risks on the basis of the Commonwealth, and not actually a demonstration that there was a high probability or potential that these risks would transpire, only just that speculation that it could be dangerous. In the Comer case, in fact, there was intoxication, and Ms. Comer was driving her child while she was intoxicated. It was not an extremely high level of intoxication, but my recollection was that once she took the intoxilizer sometime after the accident, it was a 0.09.
In Comer, the panel discussed at great length how one of the reasons we would conclude that a 0.09 wasn't sufficient is there is also another statute that covers DUI with a child in the backseat of the car. To the extent that Comer turns on that, there's nothing like that here, is there?
Well, I think, for example, the court could have convicted of contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Miller versus Commonwealth is a similar case. There was a toddler who was left unsupervised for an hour in a car, and in that instance, the defendant was convicted of contributing. And so in that instance, the court did not address this question of whether leaving the child in the car did create such a substantial risk of harm that it would show a reckless disregard for human life. But I think there is an alternative statute that the court could have convicted under, which is contributing, which in fact I believe the trial court was asked to consider. As far as this case, I think that the facts do show that Ms. Hanna was not completely inaccessible, that the weather was mild, she was not intoxicated, she did leave for a period of time, but she was able to come and respond to the officer. And so I think that there just wasn't a showing that there was a probability of substantial risk or death or serious injury to the children. And so with the Commonwealth relying on the mere speculative possibility of harm, I would argue that that evidence is insufficient to support a conviction under this statute. That's my argument, unless there are other questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. You still have remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Chris Obenchain representing the Commonwealth in this matter. On review in this case, this Court obviously views all the facts and the reasonable inferences that flow from those facts in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth. And I think to respond to the argument that's been made here that Ms. Hannon was able to observe what was going on in the parking lot with her children, I don't believe that's a reasonable inference flowing from the facts in favor of the Commonwealth.
Is it the Commonwealth's position that any parent who leaves an infant in a car while they run into a store for any period of time is guilty of a felony?
No, Your Honor. That's okay. Not the Commonwealth's
How
position.
How do we distinguish this case from that scenario?
Your Honor,
is it the time involved?
I would respond, I think what, and going back to the Coomer kind of question, what Coomer looked at was kind of a per se question. Is intoxication with a child in the car per se child neglect or abuse? And I think what Ms. Hannon is asking for in this case is sort of a per se rule, which is that 15 minutes is not long enough to constitute.
Well, what distinguishes this factual situation from me leaving my child in the car while I run in and drop off the laundry?
I think it's the totality of the circumstances, Your
what
Honor.
Circumstances?
And I think in this case, what we have is Ms. Hannon making the choice to take her two children, two young children. So first we have to look at the ages of the children. That's certainly relevant. You know, if it was a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old, I don't think we'd be here. So the ages of the children are relevant. We have a 5-year-old and a 4-month-old, not old enough to recognize the risks that are around them or to be responsible for watching each other while the parent is away. We also have to look at the fact that she chose to take those children out of the safety of the home and take them to a public place during rush hour.
Is there any evidence that the home is actually safer?
Well, I think it's a relevant fact, Your Honor.
Everybody has heard the statistic that most accidents occur in the home. Now, that's probably statistically tortured a little bit because most people spend most of their time in the home. But you've asserted that the home is safer. What's the evidence of that?
Well, there's no evidence in the record, obviously, Your Honor, that Ms. Hannon's home is safer than this parking lot. I guess I would have to concede.
The totality of the circumstances that you just discussed are present when I drop off my laundry and leave my 5-year-old child in the car. So it seems to me that you are asking us to create a bright line that said if you leave a young infant in a car while you go into a store for any period of time, you have committed a willfully bad act, a felony.
We're not asking the court to create a bright line rule, Your Honor. What we're asking the court to do is to examine the record and determine whether there's any evidence to support the trial court's conclusion.
But that's all that there is in the record. I mean, the best you got is there were numerous vehicles coming in and out. Well, there's numerous vehicles that pass my house every day, and if my 5-year-old is out in the yard, then they're subject to the same risk.
Your Honor, there is another fact that I hadn't yet reached that I would raise to the court, which is the fact that the doors to the car were unlocked, that all of the doors were unlocked. And I think that is what particularly the trial court looked at in terms of the reckless disregard for the life of the children as being an important fact. And I would point the court to the Barnes decision, which supports that. That the trial court in that case, that was a prosecution under the child endangerment statute as opposed to this statute, but the criminal negligence standard is the same in both instances.
Mr. Obenchain, the last time this court sat, either in this courthouse or in Salem, we decided Coomer. And what we decided, what the panel decided, and I know your office has appealed that, you're aware that we're bound by it under the interpanel accord doctrine, found that driving while intoxicated on rainy roads at night did not was not sufficient to establish a substantial risk or probability of serious injury or death to the child. How do we find that leaving the children in a parking lot while you run into a store is substantially riskier or more probable to cause injury or death? Because it seems to me that one of those is inherently more dangerous than the other, but it's the driving while intoxicated.
Well, again, first of all, I would...
Does the Commonwealth reject that the premise of my question, that the driving while intoxicated would strike most people as inherently more dangerous?
I don't reject the premise of the court's question. I think I would first note that, you know, again, this court understands that we afford a range of discretion to prosecutors and to judges, to trial courts in determining these issues. And I think because we may have done something different in this case.
But we reversed those very choices in Coomer. And it seems to me that if what happened in Coomer raised a more substantial risk or a higher probability of serious injury or death, there's no way that we can say that this also violates that same statute.
I would disagree, Your Honor, and I would distinguish Coomer on a couple of instances. I think it's distinguishable both legally and factually. I think legally, the court in Coomer was deciding, is there a per se rule against driving while intoxicated with a child in the car? And the Court of Appeals essentially said, we're not drawing a bright line rule and saying this is per se child neglect.
Isn't what the Court of Appeals said? It's not per se simply because you're driving drunk, but then they had to analyze the fact that she was driving drunk and it didn't reach the requisite level of probability of serious injury or substantial risk.
And that's where I think there's a factual distinction in the cases, is that in Coomer, the parents took some reasonable steps to try to care for the children, and they had hired a babysitter. The babysitter fell through. They had to go pick up the child. They had no other choice.
They could have stayed where they picked up the child.
And then the evidence also showed, Your Honor, that they, you know, as soon as they heard from the babysitter, they stopped drinking. They ate some food. They waited 20 minutes. They then went to go pick up the child. So I think the facts are a little bit different. In this case, Ms. Hannon wasn't even bothered to take the most simple precautions to protect her children, which was to lock the doors to the car.
I suspect if she'd locked the door, you'd be arguing that the car could have caught on fire and nobody could have gotten them out.
Well, we'd be here with a different case, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Evans. The statute requires this act to be willful, does it not?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And willful... We've got lots of language on that, defining that term, but by and large it means an act done with a bad purpose without justifiable excuse or without grounds or believing it to be lawful. It is intentional, knowing, or voluntary as distinguished from accidental, and a bad purpose is defined as without justifiable excuse, conduct likely to result in injury or illegality. I mean, I jumped over some of that, but you get the drift of our definition. What about this act makes it willful in the sense that it was done for a bad purpose without justifiable excuse or without ground to believe it was lawful?
I would point again to the fact that the doors were left unlocked as being a fact which demonstrates the willful and reckless disregard for the children.
Would you agree with me that parents throughout this Commonwealth do this every day?
I would agree with you, Your Honor, and I don't dispute that, you know, this is obviously not the most serious case of child abuse that this court has ever heard or that I've ever experienced. But it is a felony. And again...
If you agree that it's done every day, and it really posed a substantial risk or a probability of serious injury or death, wouldn't we be inundated of cases of children having suffered these every day?
Well, I wouldn't agree that all of these, that the totality of these circumstances happen every day. I would agree. I think I understood the question asked, wouldn't you agree that cars are left unlocked every day in the Commonwealth?
And
I agree with that.
Children are left in cars while parents run in and do brief errands in stores.
I would agree with that. But, again, brief errands is different, I think, from the facts and the reasonable inferences drawn from the facts in this case. 15 minutes may not seem like a long time, particularly to an adult, but to a young child where there are...
I imagine this 15 minutes seems very long to you right now.
It certainly does, Your Honor.
You know, we have used language...
The difference is that I'm old enough to be able to take care of myself, Your Honor, and I think... You know, we have a different scenario. And I would also point to the fact, again, there was another individual that pulled up next to the evidence shows Mr. Custer had pulled up next to Ms. Hannon's car, that he was parked next to the car. He observed the children for about 10 minutes before he called police. Police then had an opportunity to arrive. So the idea that she was able to observe what was going on outside, I don't think is a reasonable inference, because Mr. Custer was there for 10 minutes. And who knows what he could have done.
Hypothetically, if there had been a series of child abductions in the area, would that be a piece of evidence that the Commonwealth would have been able to introduce to prove this, to prove the substantial risk of injury?
I think the Commonwealth could have introduced that evidence.
Okay. I certainly think that would go to possibility of significant risk of injury, given that there was no such evidence or anything like it, or as I understand the record, no evidence of lots of people being hit in that parking lot or anything. It's just a parking lot. From the record, it is a normal, everyday parking lot. If there's no plus factor, how do we get to substantial risk or probability?
I think, again, looking at the court's analysis in the Barnes case, that a parent leaving the children alone, unattended, unlocked apartment for enough time to go to the store, pick up some groceries, and come home was enough to support, you know, was enough evidence to support a conviction for child endangerment. That analysis tells us that the trial court in this instance was not plainly wrong or without any evidence to support its conclusion that driving to this location, cars coming in and out, leaving the children alone, unattended, unable to respond to them if anything happened, which I think is a reasonable inference in the Commonwealth's favor from the evidence, unlocked car is sufficient evidence to support the trial court's conclusion in this case.
One of the terms we have used in describing gross, wanton, and culpable negligence, and this comes from a Kaufman versus Garnett, it must be such a degree of negligence as would shock fair-minded people. Would you agree that we've used that language?
I would agree the courts use that language in some cases.
In this case, the Child Protective Services did not make a finding on this that there was, find the violation, didn't do anything. Would you consider them to be fair-minded people when it comes to the care of children?
I'm sure Child Protective Services are.
I mean, that's my
full of
my
fair-minded
point is it
people,
certainly
Your
didn't
Honor.
Shock the conscience of the Child Protective Services people.
Well, I mean, I would say I think a fact, you know, that's relevant is the Commonwealth. You know, the children were removed from her custody for the night. Her mother came and picked them up immediately. I think that's also a relevant fact that she had other options available to her than taking the children and leaving them unattended in an unlocked car. I mean, she could have called the mother to watch them while she went to the store. She could have taken the mother to the store with her. She could have taken the children into the store with her. So I think there were other options available. And I think the trial court's reliance on the analysis in Miller is relevant because Miller talks about, you know, the potential hazards to an unattended toddler span the range of imagination of the average person.
But Miller was contributing to the delinquency charge, which is a misdemeanor.
I agree, but the trial court relied on it for the purposes of analyzing the willfulness of the conduct.
Well, right, but the Miller opinion itself drops a footnote and says that was a mistake and they shouldn't have done it. But they were stuck with the jury instruction, correct? That's footnote 3 in Miller?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you very much for your argument.
We ask you to affirm.
Ms. Reynolds, you have your rebuttal time. You have 5 minutes remaining for rebuttal.
Ms. Reynolds, while you're walking up, I would ask you to consider this. Obviously, the Coomer case is a case that arguably supports your position. Do you believe that the Coomer case overrules this court's opinion in Bean Brewer versus Commonwealth? And I'm going to give you the language so you're not at a disadvantage. Appellate's conduct must be of a wanton and willful nature, showing a reckless disregard or indifferent disregard of the rights of others under circumstances reasonably calculated to produce injury or which makes it improbable that injury will be occasioned. How do we reconcile the language in Bean Brewer with our result in Coomer?
My understanding of that language is it's a definition of gross negligence, and it's defining gross negligence such that it's under circumstances reasonably calculated to produce injury or make it not improbable that injury will result. The Coomer case seems to be, I don't know if it overrules that case per se, but it seems like what Coomer is saying is that in that instance, that the facts that were brought before the court simply did not rise to that level, that there wasn't evidence that the court could then conclude that there was such a substantial risk or probability of potential injury that it rose to the level of gross negligence.
Well, Bean Brewer involved a violation of an administrative code pertaining to daycare facilities. So it was a little more there than just failure to supervise.
That's a friendly question.
That's a friendly question.
Not.
The answer is yes.
I think
would
that...
Would you agree, though, that the statute as it's written is, I'd like to say, prospective in nature, and let me provide my definition of what I mean by prospective in nature, is that the statute is intending to prevent a foreseeable harm. In other words, putting people on notice that putting children at risk or putting anyone who falls within the statute at risk is something that you should consider, and it's reasonably foreseeable that if certain things occur, a child could be put at risk, and therefore there is criminal liability associated with that.
I think that is correct, and I think that the statute does consider potential harm, certainly.
But is it something that is merely foreseeable, or is it something more than that?
I think it might have to be something more than that. I think it might have to be a real substantial risk or probability. And I think that there's a spectrum of culpable behavior. And one end of that spectrum might be, as the court noted earlier, driving while intoxicated with a child in the car. And I think the question is, where are we on that spectrum of culpable behavior here in this case? If that case was not enough, if this is less culpable, this is something that is done sort of in the ordinary course of life by parents every day, then it's not rising to that level of felonious behavior. In fact, in the Coomer case, there in fact was an accident. Fortuitously, the child wasn't injured, but there in fact was an accident. And in this case, there was no harm to the children. And I think that one thing that addresses what the court was noting is that you do have to look at the totality of the circumstances. So had this been noon in July and it was 100 degrees, that would be different. But that's not our case.
That's the Kelly case.
Exactly. But so that's not our case. And so I think that in those situations where the risk is so great, it's different. And in this instance, I think the risk is merely speculative, and it is not so great. And so in that spectrum of culpable behavior, I don't think that this action rose to the level of a felony conviction when this mother did something that many parents frequently do.
I think the argument that this is what people frequently do helps you, because a lot of people frequently smoke marijuana, but it's still legal.
It is illegal as of today, Your Honor. I think that is correct. I think that there are some bright line rules in the law. At the same time, I don't know that the law asks of us perfect behavior at all times, and that in some instances there may be a spectrum of the most ideal behavior, and then what it is that people do. And I'm not sure that we can ask people to have perfect actions at all times.
In an unpublished opinion dealing with the misdemeanor, Shiflett, a judge formerly of this court, now a justice, said that the parenting was appalling, but not necessarily criminal. Is that essentially your position?
Yes, sir, and I had not read that opinion, but we have a juvenile domestic relations court judge, and he often says there is behavior that is criminal, there is behavior that requires intervention by social services, and then there's everyday behavior. And in this instance, yes, social services came, but they did find that it was an unfounded complaint, meaning there was not a basis to pursue further actions against Ms. Hannon, that they did not feel that it rose to that level in their professional assessment. So our argument here was that this behavior simply was not gross, wanton, and culpable to show a reckless disregard for human life, and we would ask the court to reverse the conviction.
Thank you for your argument. We'll greet counsel, and then we'll take up Hubbard versus